Aloha kākou, valina kākou. Greetings, everyone. My name is Dr. Kehaulani Kawanui, and I'm your host on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and beyond. We are broadcasting from the studios of WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, also known as Mattabesset, the traditional homeland of the Wangunk Indian tribe. This program features the political and cultural struggles of Native American and other Indigenous peoples. If you would like to contact me, I can receive emails with your feedback on the program. The address is indigenouspolitics@wesufm.org. Today we have a very special guest, Andy Major. He is a staff person at the Syracuse Peace Council and one of the founders of Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation, a group that is a project of the Peace Council. The Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation is a solidarity group made up of residents of New York State who support the land rights action filed by the Onondaga Nation against the state of New York on March 11, 2005. We will learn more about this organization and how it is distinctly different from the numerous anti-Indian organizations that are flourishing in this country, who oppose tribal land rights and self-determination. Often, this anti-Native American racism is thinly veiled behind the purported quest for equality, where these organizations want to see the collective rights of tribal nations reduced to individuals of indigenous descent who have no distinct claim to sovereignty or nationhood. There are dozens of anti-Native American groups, and they are growing in the United States, and actively oppose tribal governments and their unique legal relationship with the U.S. federal government. Because American Indians were the original inhabitants of what is now considered the United States, their pre-existence necessitated the negotiation of political compacts, treaties, and alliances with intruding European nations and the United States. As Lumbee legal scholar David E. Wilkins delineates, as recognized sovereigns, Indian peoples are subject to the U.S. trust doctrine, which is supposed to be a unique legal relationship with the U.S. government that entails protection. Notable groups against the rights of Native Americans include two sister organizations, the Citizens Equal Rights Foundation and the Citizens Equal Rights Alliance. The mission statement of both claims that, quote, federal Indian policy is unaccountable, destructive, racist, and unconstitutional. It is therefore our mission to ensure the equal protection of the law as guaranteed to all citizens by the Constitution of the United States of America, end quote. Unfortunately, the organizations are either unaware or unconcerned with the fact that the U.S. Constitution excludes American Indian tribes. In fact, the U.S. Constitution only mentions Indian tribes in two places. The first is Section 8, Paragraph 3, which gives Congress the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations, the states, and the Indian tribes. In other words, the U.S. federal government will not allow any state or foreign nation to interfere in the commerce with tribal nations, since the U.S. government asserts and reserves the right to interact in that nation-to-nation capacity. The second part of the U.S. Constitution mentioning American Indians is Section 2, Paragraph 3, where the formula for determining the apportionment for representatives to Congress and direct taxes states, quote, excluding Indians not taxed, end quote. Here, the constitutional phrase specifically makes a distinction between tribal Indians having no relationship to the states and individual Indians considered to be regular citizens over whom the states might extend tax liabilities. In other words, the U.S. Constitution acknowledges the separation of tribal governments and their citizens from other U.S. citizens. Of course, this might seem complicated by the fact that the U.S. unilaterally made Indians U.S. citizens through the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924. But this has meant that Indians of federally recognized tribes have dual citizenship, while Indians who are not tribal members are merely considered U.S. citizens. In any case, the Citizens Equal Rights Foundation and the Citizens Equal Rights Alliance both misconstrue the rights of tribal governments as rights-based groups based on race. And therefore, they argue that Native American rights are racist against non-Native Americans. As such, these groups are monitoring the move by tribes to put fee simple land into trust. They're also monitoring Indian tribal governments' influence on non-tribal elections, the U.S. federal recognition process, tribal hunting and fishing, environmental jurisdiction, land claims, water claims, gaming issues, and treaty rights. Another key organization in the battle against tribes in the United States is a group called One Nation United, which claims to represent concerned citizens, community organizations, state and national trade groups, local governments, businesses large and small, agriculture and law enforcement leaders, and elected officials in 39 states across the U.S. Founded in 1989 in Washington State as United Property Owners, they eventually merged with One Nation of Oklahoma to become One Nation United. The group claims to represent more than 300,000 U.S. citizens who have joined together to defend their private property rights, protect the free enterprise system, and reform what they see as seriously flawed federal Indian policy for the benefit of Indians. One Nation United is committed to stopping the expansion of tribal businesses and influence, and to do so they have engaged in several major lawsuits, ranging from a case that now requires tribes to follow state campaign finance laws to a decision that a tribe cannot block development of a power plant on sacred lands. In the context of upstate New York, there is a group called Upstate Citizens for Equality, based out of Verona, New York, that opposes the Indian land claims and what they see as flawed federal Indian policy. Upstate Citizens for Equality currently has three chapters with a combined membership of around 10,000 people. Most recently, the group adamantly opposed what they misconstrued as the establishment of an independent, sovereign Cayuga Indian Nation within New York State. Although the Cayuga Indian Nation worked to reclaim traditional homelands, they were working within the confines of the domestic dependent nationhood model within existing federal policy, as well as the nation-to-nation treaty rights. The U.S. federal government prohibits tribal nations from exercising their full sovereignty. Regardless, the Upstate Citizens for Equality group opposed the tribe's right to assert its jurisdiction over its own homelands and opposed the tribe's right to assert its own governance. Ironically, the group accused the nation of wanting to checkerboard the landscape with a reservation they deemed foreign. The organization also falsely assumed that the restored nationhood status would result in the Cayuga Indians' loss of civil and personal rights guaranteed under the U.S. Constitution and through New York State laws and agencies, since it argued that Indian tribal constitutions take precedence over the U.S. Constitution on reservations. But this is a gross factual error, since the passage of the Indian Civil Rights Act in 1968. This legislation was passed by Congress in an attempt to impose upon tribal governments certain restrictions and protections afforded by the U.S. Constitution. Besides mobilizing against the Cayuga Indian Nation, the group has also organized rallies at the Oneida Tribe's gas stations and casinos in the past. Additionally, Daniel Warren, the chairman of the Niagara Frontier chapter of Upstate Citizens for Equality, has commenced a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act and the tribal state compact between the Seneca Nation and New York that authorizes the Seneca Buffalo Creek Casino. Despite the group's track record of anti-Indian organizing and actions, the Upstate Citizens for Equality deny any racism on their part because of their commitment to equality. However, in these cases, equality is a farce in that it is used to dispossess tribal governments of their nationhood, lands, and resources. Today's show focuses on a different kind of non-Indigenous group of citizens, those who have organized support for the Indian Nation on whose lands they reside, the neighbors of the Onondaga Nation. Before I address the neighbors, let me tell you a bit about the Onondaga. The Onondaga Nation is an Indian nation and a member of the Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy, also known as the Haudenosaunee. The other nations that make up the Haudenosaunee are the Mohawk, Oneida, Cayuga, Seneca, and Tuscarora Nations. The Haudenosaunee is recognized in three treaties made with the United States, and all of its members are federally recognized Indian nations. The Onondaga Nation continues to maintain its ancient form of government, including a traditionally selected Council of Chiefs. The nation's present territory is south of Syracuse, New York. According to their tribal website, the Onondaga Nation is taking action to assert its legal rights to its own homelands in central New York, with the principal goal of achieving legal recognition of land title, but without suing individual landowners. The Onondaga Nation seeks legal recognition of its title to the lands that were unlawfully taken by New York State in violation of the Federal Trade and Intercourse Acts and other federal laws and treaties. The U.S. recognized these lands as belonging to the Onondaga Nation, along with additional lands belonging to other members of the Haudenosaunee, in the 1784 Treaty of Fort Stanwix and the 1794 Treaty of the Canandaigua. The Onondaga Nation asserts that its land title action is based on the U.S. Constitution, both of these treaties, and the Federal Trade and Intercourse Acts. The Trade and Intercourse Act of 1790 and its subsequent reenactments state that, quote, no purchase, grant, lease, or other conveyance of land from an Indian tribe is valid without the participation and approval of the United States government, end quote. Between 1790 and 1822, the state of New York signed 5 so-called treaties with individual members of the Onondaga Nation, supposedly acquiring all of the nation's lands except for the 7,300-acre territory where the nation resides today. The state later sold most of the land to others. None of these so-called treaties was ever ratified nor approved by the Onondaga Nation itself, by the Haudenosaunee, nor by the U.S. government, and therefore none are valid. These so-called treaties initiated by the state of New York violated federal law because they purported to acquire tracts of Onondaga land for the state of New York without U.S. government approval or participation. Therefore, the Onondaga Nation has asked the U.S. to file suit in federal court together with the nation. The U.S. Supreme Court has decided that under such circumstances, title to the land continues to belong to the original Indian Nation owner. This was decided in the case of County of Oneida, New York versus Oneida Indian Nation of New York State. Perhaps the most dramatic impact has been on Onondaga Lake, which has been designated as a Superfund site by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Within the waters and sediments of the lake, the Environmental Protection Agency has found dangerous levels of numerous hazardous materials, including pesticides, creosote, polycyclic hydrocarbons, volatile organic compounds, lead, cobalt, mercury, and polychlorinated biphenyls. These last 4 substances are on the U.S. Agency for Toxic Substance and Disease Registry's list of the 20 most toxic substances. The Environmental Protection Agency has designated 15 other Superfund sites within Onondaga County, the center of the land claim. High levels of pollution have gravely damaged the land and the entire environment in which the Onondaga have lived for centuries. Of course, this destruction has impaired the nation's ability to subsist and has limited its options for economic development. The Onondaga Nation asserts that its ultimate purpose in the assertion of its land rights is to enable the nation to maintain its culture and way of life and to protect the earth and its environments for all inhabitants of central New York, and that they are not seeking anything not already granted by U.S. law. The nation believes that the successful reassertion of its land rights will help improve the overall quality of life and the environmental health of the region. The Onondaga Nation has made it clear that they want to economically develop in order to secure an adequate supply of housing, an adequate supply of quality housing, quality education system, affordable quality health care, sound and sustainable environmental programs, programs for the proper care of elders and the youth, a program for environmental restoration and protection, and employment opportunities for the nation and its neighbors. The Onondaga Nation's other stated aims include the desire to protect and conserve the natural resources within and affecting the nation's land as a means of safeguarding all citizens' rights to a natural, healthy environment. As a result, they would then be empowered to secure Onondaga rights to hunt, fish and gather for subsistence and cultural needs, secure adequate protection for the burial sites of their ancestors, as well as other important sacred and archaeological sites, and resolve all ongoing conflicts with the state and federal governments, particularly regarding taxation and jurisdiction. Finally, they hope to provide for the growth and perpetuation of Onondaga culture, language, laws, religion, and way of life. Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation, also known as NUN, is an organization of Central New Yorkers that recognizes and supports the sovereignty of the traditional government of the Onondaga Nation. It is a program of the Syracuse Peace Council, which supports the right of Native peoples to reclaim land and advocates for fair settlement of any claims which are filed. Our guest today, Andy Major, is one of the co-founders of Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation. He will join us for an interview right after this song break.
Oh,
And that was Joanne Shenandoah with a track called Circle from her CD called Covenant. Andy Major is a staff person at the Syracuse Peace Council and one of the founders of the Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation, a project of the Peace Council. He has been active in movements for peace, social justice, and environmental protection for over 25 years as an organizer, trainer, activist, writer, and speaker. Andy began working with the people at the Onondaga Nation in 1982 when Dennis Banks sought sanctuary there. Andy has spoken and written widely on nonviolence and social change, resistance to war, a Jewish peace perspective on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and other issues. He lives in Syracuse with his partner and their 5-year-old son. Aloha, Andy Major.
Aloha. Glad to be with you, Kahalani.
Thank you for joining us today on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. I want to dive in and ask you about your organization. How did this grassroots group start, and how is it connected to the Syracuse Peace Council?
Well, Noon started around 2000, and it's really kind of the latest incarnation of various efforts on the part of the Syracuse Peace Council and other progressive activists in central New York to work in support of the Onondaga Nation and other indigenous peoples in our region.
Mm-hmm.
It started in 2000, was a time when there were active land claims to the east with the Oneida Nation and to the west with the Cayuga Nation.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a grassroots anti-Indian organization called Upstate Citizens for Equality, which was getting a lot of publicity, a lot of support in those areas. And many of us were close enough to the Onondaga Nation that we knew that they also planned to go to court at some point to seek justice for the illegal taking of their land. And we began talking about starting now to do educational work to try and prevent the sort of backlash that UCE was about.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought that for a variety of reasons that we could really head off that kind of activity in our region. And so we began educating ourselves a little more about the issues and figuring out how we could really be allies to the Onondaga Nation in this struggle. While we come with our own concerns and our own agenda,
mm-hmm.
to us being allies really means figuring out directly from people at Onondaga what would be useful to them and then trying to assist with that. So that's really the path we've been on ever since. And we're actually really quite proud of the fact that that there has not been that sort of anti-Onondaga development that has really spawned in this community.
Mm-hmm.
And that's despite the fact that Upstate Citizens for Equality has made several efforts to try and build kind of a branch or a chapter in this region,
mm-hmm.
but they've been completely unsuccessful at doing that. And much of the credit for that really goes to the Onondaga Nation, how they've proceeded, who they are, and how they conduct themselves. But
mm-hmm.
we think that Noon deserves a little bit of credit in helping out as well.
Yes. And so the Syracuse Peace Council is explicitly a progressive organization. Would you say that in contrast to Upstate Citizens for Equality, that they're a more conservative or right-wing organization?
Certainly. Upstate Citizens for Equality primarily speaks to, you know, native land claims issues, or Indian land claims, as they would call them.
Mm-hmm.
The current leader of that group recently wrote a letter to the local newspaper attacking the Peace Council on a variety of issues, including the Iraq War, which was sort of surprising to us because they typically haven't addressed other issues, but certainly taxes, keeping taxes low, property rights, those typical conservative issues are their core, as well as promoting what we believe is racism in
mm-hmm.
terms of their understanding of the history of what has happened in this country and what makes sense in terms of moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
So the Peace Council is the oldest continuously active grassroots peace and social justice organization in the country. It was founded in 1936.
Oh, wow.
And has maintained an active campaign ever since. So, and obviously our work with Noon is part of our concern for social justice, and wanting to address issues of justice and peace right here in our own community,
yes,
as well as on a global scale.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like this was more of a preemptive move. Now, how did the members of the Syracuse Peace Council that started the Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation, how did you anticipate that the Onondaga Nation was going to be pursuing a land rights action? There must have been some interaction through the Peace Council itself with Onondaga citizens?
Yeah, well, as I think I alluded to before, this is kind of the latest incarnation of efforts in support of Onondaga that, you know, we actually haven't tried to trace the early origins of that history, but at least since the early 1970s, there's been alliances between the Peace Council and some of the leadership at Onondaga and individual citizens there, members of the nation.
Mm-hmm.
There were supports of takeovers of land in the late 1970s in northern New York that the Peace Council was involved with. And I became involved myself in the early 1980s when Dennis Banks, a former leader of the American Indian Movement, sought sanctuary at the Onondaga Nation in the hopes of then getting sanctuary in all of New York State, which ultimately was not successful. But I worked as a member of the Peace Council with people at Onondaga and other activists around New York State, trying to pressure New York State government to welcome Dennis here in the state as a whole. And that was my first connection with people at Onondaga. And some of the other people in Noon were connected with that. And others got involved in the mid-1990s. There was an effort really to overthrow the traditional government at Onondaga. Some business people there who had cigarette shops and gas stations that benefited from the nation's tax-free status tried to use those resources to undermine the traditional government. And eventually there were the Klan mothers blockaded a number of those businesses. And some women activists from Syracuse went down to sort of join them in solidarity and ended up gaining the understanding that bringing, you know, hot food and warm socks was one way to express their support. So they did that and then just began to develop friendships with some of the Klan mothers and other Onondaga women who were staffing those blockades. So that's sort of another of the antecedents of Noon. So through those relationships, we were aware that Onondaga people have you know, for generations, understood that their land was taken from them illegally and that they didn't accept that and wanted to try and find some remedy. And as initially, the Oneida case, you know, went to the Supreme Court and was validated as having the right to move forward.
Yes.
That we knew that accelerated discussions at Onondaga about how to proceed. So that's what we were thinking in 2000. In some ways, I think it surprised us that it took 5 years at that point before the Onondagas actually went to court. And I obviously am not the person to talk about that, but my understanding is that, you know, much of it was really wanting to figure out how to move forward with a level of sort of dignity and integrity in terms of what they were seeking and how they were doing it, and trying to build real unanimity in their community in support of going to court.
I see. So within the goals of the Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation, Noon, you've got the solidarity piece of that. And within the context of supporting their land claims, what are some of the specific goals of the organization? Say a newcomer turns up and wants to understand this. What would you say are the goals within that context?
Well, certainly one of the things that we want to emphasize, which is really a complete contradiction to Upstate Citizens for Equality, is that we recognize the sovereignty of the Onondaga Nation, that they are a separate, independent nation that has historical government-to-government relationships through treaties with the United States of America, with our nation. And so that we believe that's the nature of the relationship. UCE believes that, you know, they should be just like any other American and follow all the laws and cultural customs of the United States. So that respect for an understanding of Onondaga sovereignty is key. A second piece is that we believe in justice, and we think that the Onondagas have been treated very, very badly and want to see some level of justice. They aren't calling for, and we don't support the idea that all of the people of European descent or from other parts of the world who now inhabit this area need to evacuate and go back where they came from. but we need to figure out within the context of where we are now,
mm-hmm.
how can we seek to make amends for the fact that, you know, almost all of their land was taken from them, that there were efforts to destroy their culture, that children were taken from their families and put in boarding schools where
yes.
they were taught that their language, that their spirituality, that their way of life were barbarous and uncivilized and unacceptable. Those are crimes, and we need to find ways to try and redress them in some way. And exactly how that will turn out or what a reasonable solution will look like, we don't know. What we ultimately would like, and I think what the Onondagas would like as well, is that this not be worked out in court, but
mm-hmm.
rather through negotiations between the leadership of the Onondaga Nation and the leadership of New York State and the affected communities to figure out how can we work together to redress these crimes.
I see. So a socially just form of coexisting and yet still really grappling with the legacy of settler colonialism is what it sounds like.
Exactly. And part of it is that Noon believes that our nation, the United States, and the world are really in a deep crisis. And many other people would agree with us about this. And while we don't want to put the Onondaga on some pedestal that they've figured everything out, or that, you know, that the solution to the problems of 2008 lie in going back to, you know, 1680,
mm-hmm.
but we believe that there's a knowledge, a wisdom, a connection with the earth, a way of thinking about life that they've developed through their culture, through their spirituality, that may hold some important keys for us if we as a human race are going to survive.
Yes.
So we believe that working for justice for the people of the Onondaga Nation really is in the best interests of all of humanity and the entire creation as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, neighbors of the Onondaga Nation, and for our listeners, if you hear Noon, that's the acronym, Noon, has worked to promote an understanding of and respect for the Onondaga people and history and culture, and that's what I hear you saying.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of a goal within the central New York community. Can you tell us more about how the group has undertaken that project of getting the broader public to learn more?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've engaged in a wide variety of educational outreach, really four main ways we've done that. One is we've sought venues to make presentations to Rotary clubs, to classes, to faith communities, churches and synagogues, etc., to go in and talk a little bit about the Onondaga Nation, who they are, about Noon, what we seek, about our understanding of the history that has unfolded,
yes.
and what we can do about it now. And we've probably made about 50 presentations over the past 6 or 7 years.
Wow.
And almost all of them have been conducted by someone from Noon and a representative from the Onondaga Nation, because we don't see it as our role at all to speak for them or to represent their voice, but rather to speak in our own voice as citizens of the United States about and Central New York residents about what we want to see happen.
Yes.
So those educational presentations to existing groups is one piece. A second piece has been organizing larger educational events in the community at large. And in 2006, we initiated and coordinated a very high-profile year-long educational series that was a collaboration between our organization, Syracuse University, and the State University of New York School of Environmental Science and Forestry, that we had monthly events that were at this place, Syracuse Stage, which is connected with the university but is really a community venue,
mm-hmm.
And held a series of 11 programs, drawing anywhere from 150 to 450 people.
Wow.
And we were really pleased with the turnout, with the level of interest. We got quite a good deal of media attention for those events.
Yes.
And they provided opportunities for scholars, for Onondaga people and other Haudenosaunee or Iroquois people, and community activists to share what they've learned. And one of the pieces that I found most interesting, those ended up often also being a native person and a non-native person mm-hmm. sharing the stage together, or in some cases it was more than two people.
Mm-hmm.
But in one case, Chief Irving Powlis, who's a longtime chief of the Onondaga Nation, spoke along with Robert Venables, who's a scholar who has really sought to dig deep into this history.
Mm-hmm.
And they talked about how Bob Venables showed up one day at Irving's home on Onondaga Nation 30-some-odd years ago and talked about his interest in being a scholar. And Chief Powlis related to him the oral history that he had learned about what had happened between our peoples. And Bob Venables said, well, none of that's in the history books. That's not at all how it's told. And over these last 30 years, Chief Powlis has continued to share these stories, and Bob Venables has done archival research. In some cases, he went to England and went through papers and letters that no one had ever opened before.
Wow.
And time after time, what he's found is that the oral history is validated by the record.
Yes.
If white scholars take the time and bother to look deeply enough into it. So I think that was very moving for people to hear that that kind of history and understanding of how, you know, we as white people say, well, it's not written down, so it can't be real.
And
the Onondagas say, this is what we've learned. And in this case, in general, historical records were unearthed to validate it.
So really the enacting of the partnership led to that development.
Yes, very much so. And the openness on the part of Bob Venables to really look for, to see if this history could be proven, as opposed to many other historians who would say, oh, no, you know, this is what our history books say. This must be the truth. So those are two other pieces of our outreach and education. One is that we've published a wide range of printed materials about the history of the relationship between the Onondaga Nation and the broader Central New York community, about Onondaga culture, about their environmental concerns, and distributed thousands of these pamphlets by having tables at community events, by putting them in libraries and other community venues. And almost all of that material is available on our website as well, which is another piece. And then we've worked hard to get our perspective out through the mainstream media, through radio and TV talk shows, through getting information into the local newspapers, et cetera. So it's tried to be sort of a comprehensive public education campaign. Obviously, given some limitations, given that we're a grassroots organization with limited resources.
Yes. Well, that's really incredible. Could you let our listeners know the website URL, please?
Sure. It's www.peacecouncil.net/noon, which is N-O-O-N. And Peace Council is PEACECOUNCIL.net/noon.
Excellent. Thank you.
And as long as people maybe have pens, the Onondaga Nation also has a very valuable website,
yes,
which is onondaganation.org.
And that's Onondaga, spelled O-N-O-N-D-A-G-A. Now, given that the neighbors of the Onondaga Nation, Noon, is an explicitly anti-racist group, and you've alluded to the racism that the Upstate Citizens for Equality have perpetuated, how do you see racism against the Native Nations in your area? How is that manifesting in Central New York, and how does your organization directly challenge it?
Well, one of the things is to seek to validate the Onondaga version of the history of what has happened, of the responsibility of us as residents of this area to seek to redress the crimes which have occurred.
Yes.
We also seek to name racism when it's happening. Here in the area that's close to Onondaga, there certainly is racism towards Native people, job discrimination, housing discrimination, stereotyping that, you know, all Native people are alcoholics and that sort of thing. But there's also many, many people who have some connection with Onondaga or are very curious and interested in Onondaga. And I think this is true throughout our culture, that there's both a denigration of Native people and a romanticization of them at the same time. And they're obviously contradictory, but I think they're both there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and other things, I mean, for example, shortly after the Onondagas went to court, this group, Upstate Citizens for Equality, held a public meeting in Lafayette, which is the town closest to the Onondaga Nation, and it was basically an organizing meeting to try and start a local chapter of their organization. And several of us went to that meeting and challenged them publicly there. And mm-hmm. afterwards, they wrote a letter to us challenging or offering to have a public debate with us. And we talked about it a great deal in our kind of core organizing group, and we decided that there was no value for us in engaging with them in that kind of public way. Since we see them at a very core level as being based on racism, that to share a platform with a racist organization is to validate them in a way that we don't think is sensible.
I see.
From a more kind of strategic perspective, we believe that they had not gained any foothold in this community and that we had support in this community, and us sharing a stage with them would offer them potentially an opportunity to share their perspective, which we have no interest in having shared here at all. Would we have a discussion about racism towards African Americans with the Ku Klux Klan? No, of course not.
Mm-hmm.
And these folks don't, you know, they're not wearing white sheets. Often their public rhetoric is not overtly racist in the sense of saying, you know, Native Americans are inferior or not as smart or anything like that. But when you really dig down into it, it buys into the racism that says that we conquered them and dominated them, and therefore the right of the conqueror reigns in this culture, and they don't have the rights that that were agreed to in the treaties which were signed by the early founders of this nation.
Your organization has argued that all Central New Yorkers can potentially benefit from the Onondaga Nation securing their lands. I had interviewed in the past Tonya Ganella Fritschner from the American Indian Law Alliance, who is an Onondaga citizen, who told me about the good work of your organization, Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation. And she mentioned that some of the allies actually took a bus up to Albany when the land rights action was heard before the court. Could you tell us more about that and what that experience was like?
Yeah, it was a tremendous day. And we actually, in addition to going to Albany that day, we had spent quite a bit of effort working to try and build some support in the Albany area as well, so that a number of us went and held an educational program at the Unitarian Church in Albany about a week and a half before the hearing, and tried to use that as a way to draw out people from the Capital District who also might be supportive. And so when we, there were two buses actually that went from the Onondaga Nation, and probably a little more than half of those were Onondaga people and a little less than half people from Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation, so people from the broader community who went in support. When we got to the courthouse in Albany, there were already, you know, a dozen or 20 Capital District area folks there with signs in support of the Onondaga Nation, in support of justice, in support of environmental cleanup. So it was really a tremendous day together, and I think that others feel similarly, that we have a responsibility. You know, we claim as a nation to believe in democracy and equality and the rights of all people, and this is an opportunity for us to stand up and make those real, to not have it be just empty rhetoric that we want to inflict on the rest of the world, but to take a hard look at what we've done and say, we're sorry. How can we try to make this right at some level?
Mm-hmm. I want to remind our listeners that when the Onondaga Nation announced its legal filing for the land claims action in early 2005, they issued a statement that explicitly said, quote, Onondaga Nation announces land rights action, promising no evictions and no casinos. Lawsuit asserts rights to historic territory that stretches from Pennsylvania to Canada. End quote. Now, for some of our listeners, they might be wondering, how could that be seen as a positive outcome for all, given the stretch of the territory being reclaimed? How instrumental do you think it was that the Onondaga Nation explicitly promised no evictions and no casinos?
I think that those are very important things. The scope of the territory, obviously, it's huge. It's a tremendous area, but that's the area that the Onondaga traditionally inhabited for hundreds and hundreds of years before Europeans reached this region. So that's what they have a right to. And, you know, they've made it clear that what they're looking for is some level of redress for the illegal taking of the land and for them to be able to rebuild a more substantial land base for their people, because their culture is very tied to the land, and the small piece of land that they have now is very insufficient for that.
Right.
And that they want the opportunity to have a real meaningful role in what happens to the environment in this entire territory. And since they went to court, they've actually been contacted by, you know, dozens of citizen organizations throughout that territory who are dealing with environmental problems. And one of the things that they've found remarkable is that those citizens of the United States, of New York State, of whatever county or town, are turning to them because the democratic systems that are supposed to protect them within the structures of the United States and New York State aren't functioning.
Mm-hmm.
So they're hoping that the Onondaga Land Rights Action can help them clean up the toxic contamination from an old factory in their village or in a stream that they hope to be able to fish in again and eat the fish out of. And
yes.
So that there's been many people who've responded very positively to what the Onondagas are calling for.
Yes, so that the nation's goal of environmental healing has played a positive role in the decision of non-natives to participate in the efforts.
Certainly.
Hypothetically, what if they wanted to assert their sovereign right to a casino? Now, where would neighbors of Onondaga in principle stand?
Well, I think our principle would stay the same, that they have a right to a casino. The Onondaga Nation does have a national business which is selling, they have a cigarette shop that sells cigarettes at a discounted price because they don't pay the federal excise tax on cigarettes. Most of us aren't smokers, oppose the influence of large tobacco companies on our culture and society.
Yes.
But we don't question their right to use that as an economic force for their people. I think we'd feel similarly about a casino. At the same time, you know, we're pleased because most of us don't believe that gambling is a socially useful thing for our culture, or frankly for Native peoples as well. It goes along with lots of alcohol abuse and economic problems, et cetera. But I mean, you know, here in our state, the state has a lottery, which is supposedly beneficial because it supports education, but that's legalized gambling as well.
Yes.
So, but at a very basic level, we believe in the sovereignty of these Native nations who reached treaties with the United States government as equal nations. And although that the power relationship has shifted considerably mm-hmm. over these hundreds of years, those are still the facts and the basis of the relationship. And part of working as allies means supporting their right to make their own decisions about things, even if the decisions they make aren't the same ones that we would make.
As we're wrapping up the interview, I want to invite you to leave our listeners with any last thoughts.
Well, this issue, like many issues that we face as a people, as a nation, as humanity, really gives us choices. And I feel lucky that I have the opportunity to work for the kind of world that I think many of us would like to see. And I think that one of the biggest impediments to us moving forward in positive directions is people believing that there's nothing they can do, that they can't make a difference. And I think that our work as neighbors of the Onondaga Nation has shown that grassroots people coming together, strategizing, sharing resources can really make a difference in our communities. And I really invite all your listeners to find ways to do that through their own lives, and we welcome you to connect further with us through our website, or I can also give the phone number, which is 315-472-5478, and we'd welcome talking with people who are considering starting similar organizations in other parts of the country.
Excellent. Thank you, Andy Major from the Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation. Appreciate you being on the call today.
Good talking with you, Caroline.
Thanks so much. Mahalo nui loa. And that was Andy Major from the Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation, which is a project of the Syracuse Peace Council in upstate New York. You're tuned in to Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. I'm your host, Dr. Kehaulani Kawanui, and we've been broadcasting from the studios of WESU in Middletown, Connecticut. I can receive emails with your feedback on the program. The address is indigenouspolitics@wesufm.org. This show is produced with the technical assistance of Rafi Stern. Thank you for tuning in. Mahalo.